it's hard not to see that this is the leveling of the playing field globally. If you're a nation state like North Korea and you can't physically engage with the United States in combat, you sure as heck can do it via cyber. Cyber is the bridge between espionage and kinetic conflict, and that's what people need to understand.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the HIP Podcast. I'm Sean Duby, Principal Technologist Americas, and your host today. Way back in 2017, the Forbes editorial board said, "Every company is a technology company, no matter what product or service it provides." What they're saying, of course, is that airlines are technology companies that are good at the logistics of moving people around in airplanes. Healthcare orgs are technology companies that are good at managing clinicians, patients, insurance, and facilities to provide services. For better or worse, technology and software now rules the world, and that has major implications for every aspect of our lives. My guest today is Dr. Chase Cunningham. Known in the cybersecurity industry as Dr. Zero Trust, Chase Cunningham has extensive experience in all aspects of enterprise security. Before joining Demoforce.com, he was the former CISO at Ericom Software. He was also previously Vice President, Principal Analyst at Forrester, where he tracked and covered all aspects of enterprise security, including Zero Trust trends, technologies, and frameworks. Creator of the Zero Trust Extended Framework and a cybersecurity expert, Chase has decades of operational experience working in various capacities supporting NSA, U.S. Navy, FBI Cyber, and other government mission groups. In particular, Chase spoke at our HIP conference last year, giving a very sobering session on cyber threat, the fifth horseman of the apocalypse, that outlined the implications that cyber threats, such as nation-state cyber warfare and cybercrime, have on our current and future world. We'll put a link to his session in the podcast. Welcome, Chase.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Yeah, it was good to be in New Orleans with you guys. That's one of my favorite towns.
Yeah, your talk has had a lot of legs. A lot of people have been discovering it and paying attention to it afterwards, and it also got a lot of word of mouth at the time saying, "Whoa, did you see that session he gave?" Everybody walked out kind of depressed, I think.
Yeah, sometimes telling people what's really going on can be depressing, but it needs to be said.
Well, exactly. And so let's start from the beginning, assuming that our audience hasn't seen your session yet. Why do you refer to cyber threats as the fifth horseman? And for the reference for people that don't know offhand, the other four are war, famine, pestilence, and death. But tell us about where cyber fits into that.
Yeah, so the point that I was trying to make in this one was really that there's a bigger geopolitical reason that cyber is becoming the agent of chaos that it really is becoming. And if you look at what's going on globally with a whole bunch of different aspects of the geopolitical stage, as far as famine, lack of food, climate change, the coming demographic collapse, those types of things, there are drivers that organizations and international groups are using to really push themselves forward. And it's crazy to me, because if you think about it, you back up from it and really understand all these different reasons for things occurring, it's hard not to see that this is the leveling of the playing field globally. If you're a nation state like North Korea and you can't physically engage with the United States in combat, you sure as heck can do it via cyber. And that's really what we're seeing. So it was just one of those ones of, let's think bigger than just cyber is cyber. Cyber is the bridge between espionage and kinetic conflict, and that's what people need to understand.
The bridge between espionage and kinetic conflict. Okay, that's a good soundbite to remember. So, yeah. So the linkage here is between the significant challenges that the world population is encountering for all of these aspects of the other four horsemen. And they are, as they face these challenges, everybody, of course, tries to figure out how to best mitigate those risks. And so what you're saying is that cyber warfare, cyber espionage, cyber crime is an asymmetric way to help mitigate that risk. Is that what you're saying?
100%. I mean, if you look at what's going on with the demographic issues in mainland China, you know, if you think about mainland China, they had the one child rule for a long time. They kind of population exploded. They try to dial it back. Then you dial it back too far. And then you move into this space now where they're not going to have enough people literally in the very near future to be able to support the Politburo. They have to do something, and they're never going to engage in kinetic conflict with an organization like the United States for a whole bunch of reasons unless they have to. So you leverage cyber conflict because there's almost no attribution. It's able to reach out internationally, and you can literally manipulate the entire economy remotely so that you can achieve those objectives. And this is where I would also argue that China has probably become the world superpower because of this willingness to engage in that type of activity. But you also see it in Russia. I mean, Russia is deeply engaged in the conflict in Ukraine. However, there are agents within inside the Russian Federation that are doing things internationally to cause chaos and conflict. And Putin has even been noted as saying that chaos is the goal. You do that via cyber. You don't do that by putting boots on ground anymore. And that is very important for everybody that's connected or digital to understand, is you are operating in a live fire battlefield environment. You're not just on the internet.
Right. So it would be easy to conflate the nation state threat actors all into the same bucket. But kind of what you're implying is that they act differently. They have maybe at a high level similar motivations, but their strategies are and philosophies are very different.
Correct. So any nation, really, the goal is to be the dominant power on the planet. I mean, that's what the U.S. has been for a long time. China wants to be that. Russia, North Korea, anybody, that the power is the ultimate aphrodisiac, right? Everyone wants to be the most powerful thing on the planet. But the way that you do that has to change with the reality of the space in which you operate. Russia does not have enough financial resources to engage in military conflict with the United States, short of nuclear conflict, which is bad for everybody. China does not wish to engage in kinetic conflict with the United States for a whole bunch of reasons. So what do? They basically rally behind these circumvented, circuitous, veiled attacks against the United States so that they can continue to push narratives and capabilities where they see them, you know, being valuable. And whether or not, you know, I'm not a political animal, but whether or not people get into it, like, there was actual Russian influence in the election. There will be Russian influence in the elections to come. There's Chinese influence in our elections. So it's a bigger, broader play. I call it like 4D chess, and people should understand that that's what's going on. It is not just geeks fighting each other digitally. This is nation state. This is the future of the planet.
I feel that the various nation states are going to be elbowing each other, trying to interfere as much as possible, and literally side by side against us in this situation. So,
well, there's no Geneva Conventions either. People should remember that. There is no standard of play. There are no rules. This is the wild, wild west.
Well, and there is an excellent point, and this is something that you bring up in your talk, specifically about China and about the rules that the West assumes. And that we, and let's, speaking of the United States in particular, that we are at least told that we follow. There's plenty of skepticism as to how far that goes. But compared to China, that makes no rules about it. Can you speak a little bit more about that and why that's one reason the playing field is different?
Yeah, so I think people typically will reference Sun Tzu as like the greatest military thinker in Chinese history. I think he was a great military thinker, but he's also very out of date, to be perfectly frank. If you look at, there's a publication called Unrestricted Warfare, and it is the English translation of a Chinese doctrine that was published by, at the time, two colonels in the Chinese army. And they basically said, look, if China wants to become the dominant player on the planet by 2035, 2050, we have to take the gloves off. And what that means is we have to be willing to engage in conflicts outside the bounds of what we currently know that we're good at. And that's what they've done. I mean, these guys were actually talking about 9/11 type attacks before 9/11. They were talking about using cyber way before cyber was ever a thing. So I think that that is worth it for people to understand. And I mean, I worked at NSA, I worked in the military, all those things. I can tell you the personally, without getting myself in trouble, like the level of requirements that we have to go through to be able to act in cyber, it's mind-boggling. It's very, very, very controlled. Whereas when you look at what's coming from these other organizations and other entities, it's a lot of try and see if it works. And if it doesn't work or you get caught, you just go, well, it wasn't us. Prove it was. And cyber is the best place for that. Attribution in cyber is comical at best, funny at worst. Most of the time when you read these reports about all the cyber working groups and those types of things, and you know, in the different agencies and entities, it's a lot of Kentucky windage.
Right. Okay. And so from the outset, we're working on under different strategies and different rule sets, different rules of engagement. And China is basically saying anything is fair game. And this has made more and more, has gotten more visibility in the last 6 to 8 months. But I don't know how widespread it is. Talk to us a little bit about how this is evidenced with Salt Typhoon and other, and we say China, and what we really mean is the PLA, the People's Liberation Army, and the Politburo, and the Chinese Communist Party, the CCP.
Yeah, so that's something that people misconstrue too, is when we in cyber talk about China, we don't mean the Chinese people. Chinese people are great. They're doing what they can. They're, you know, suffering under a system of dictatorial rule and whatever else. But the truth of the matter is the Politburo, the PLA, the CCP, it's about 1 million people in total that run a country of over 1 billion, which is kind of staggering when you think about it. They're the ones that are doing what they're doing because they want to continue to be in a position of power. And this is not something new to the Chinese. This has gone back over the course of all history. Like when the first caveman figured out he could bash the other caveman with a bigger rock, he wanted to continue to have the biggest rock. I mean, that's just how people are wired. So it's the same thing you see in Russia. Putin has declared himself president for life. But it's all those people that work in Putin's regime, they want to stay there too. Now in Russia, there's a lot of people that mysteriously fall out of windows and shoot themselves in the back of the head or whatever. But I mean, the truth of the matter is that those people are trying to stay in power because power is addictive, and that's kind of where people want to be. But it is a continuation of age-old practices that's now become digitized. None of this is new. This is just the new way of warfare.
How would you say China is doing that strategically to position themselves against the U.S. and presumably other Western nations?
So China and Russia have a distinct strategic advantage over the U.S. because we are lucky if we can have a four-year cycle of non-insanity. I mean, in the U.S., we go about every 2 years, you got congressional elections and senators. Every four, you got presidential. You've also got local elections, whatever. So the city on the hill, the shining example of democracy, is a great thing. However, in the long run, it's very difficult to have multi-decade strategic initiatives take place because it changes pretty much at least twice a decade, if not more. Whereas China, they have the Politburo and they have Xi. That's it. And they will rule and they will do what they want to do until those folks are dead in the ground. That is the plan, the plot, the scheme. Same thing for Russia. And that gives them a unique advantage because they can say, our plan is 2035, and they can literally scope it for that and start moving towards it. Whereas in democratic nations like the United States and others, you really are really lucky if you get anything done in a four-year window.
Your remarks remind me of a maxim by the Japanese swordsman Miyamoto Musashi, saying that one person that knows what he wants to do can act more strongly than a collection of people. And he used it tactically in fights, but it's the same concept of an authoritarian state being able to dictate and execute, whereas in open society, everybody's yelling at everybody else, as we are so clearly demonstrating right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good thing to be in a free nation, democracy, and all those things, but it also, to be totally honest, is a bit of a disadvantage when you're talking about global espionage and global activity.
I love a quote that came out a little while ago from Rob Joyce, where he said, I kind of look at Russia as the hurricane. It comes in fast and hard, whereas China, on the other hand, is climate change, long, slow, pervasive. How does that play into what China is doing in our critical infrastructure right now?
Yeah, so that's the thing that is most, I would say, you know, concerning to me, is that there's been a long-term practice by the Chinese to basically get themselves as deeply embedded in as many things as they possibly can. Critical infrastructure, chips, hardware, 5G, hospitals, all those things. And the question then becomes, well, why would you spend decades getting yourself embedded so deeply? Well, you would do that because at some time you're going to decide to act and leverage those capabilities. Now, luckily for the U.S., our critical infrastructure is so janky and dorked up that the ability for them to bring down the entire grid at once would never work. However, there is a very real possibility that certain major metropolises or different areas of the country that are interconnected with real stuff would have a problem should they decide to act on that. And we've been buying Chinese tech for forever. And most people also don't realize that there's a literal law in China that if you build, develop, or do anything inside of mainland China, the government has unfettered access to it. Period, point blank, end of story. So that is what has gone on with us buying that hardware, software, technology for so long. And it is here. We're way, way too far down the rabbit hole now to start just saying, let's rip it up. Unless you want to go live back in the 1800s with candles, it's not going anywhere.
Those of you that have TP-Link home routers, pay attention, right?
Yeah, I mean, TP-Link home routers, if you've got stuff that's using wireless NIC cards, if you have a whole lot of those tools and technologies, just go look at the chain of sort of authority on where that comes from, and you'll be kind of surprised to go, oh, it says made in America. Well, it might have been assembled in America, but it was built and, you know, basically designed, deployed, and put in play in China.
Well, and so we talk about China's insertion into our critical infrastructure to give them leverage if and when they decide to do something about it. And so what you hear, the normal human reaction is, well, we should attack back, or we should threaten, or we should attack back. What are your thoughts about offensive cyber? Or reactive cyber?
So to steal one of the folks who's a lot smarter than me, not nearly as good looking, but his name is Michael McLaughlin. He's written a book called Battlefield Cyber. One of his ideas as far as kind of projecting stuff where it's a combination of cyber and kinetic towards China that would be off-putting to them is there's a series of islands outside of China in the Pacific that China has kind of taken over, and they're solely military. Like they've been doing this surreptitiously for a while. They're even literally building islands so they can build bases on top of them. His idea, and I agree with it totally, is the next time that there is an attributed cyber attack inside of the United States, we should fling a couple missiles downrange onto one of those particular islands, because China says they're not their islands. They don't really claim them, but they're clearly theirs. And they also wouldn't be able to do anything about it, because then they would have to accept attribution. But that would also say, like, look, we're not playing. If you do the things that you're doing and we know about it, we are willing to act kinetically to defend ourselves. So there has to be a bit of a kinetic action on top of all the cyber war, because eventually electrons don't really matter. We've been doing this for so long. It's not causing anything. And the U.S. is not going to do some of the stuff that these other nations do. We're not going to target hospitals. We're not going to bring down pharmacies, stuff like that. But if it's a military target, all bets are off.
So then it becomes a question of ensuring our measuring to avoid escalation.
I mean, it becomes one of those razor's edge things, right? Where, you know, you never can know with certainty, okay, well, let's say that there's one small island and there's, you know, an airstrip there. Let's say we bomb the airstrip and no Chinese citizens or soldiers are harmed. Does that give China the impetus to say, well, that's a declaration of war, even though they don't own the island and no other people were there? It's a razor's edge. Like, I wouldn't want to be the people making that decision. However, strategically thinking, me being armchair quarterback here, I think it's a good idea as far as letting them know, like, we're not playing around. I mean, if you look at what the Israelis did with Hezbollah a while back. Israelis don't play. They failed kindergarten. They let everybody know, like, look, if you do things against us, eventually we can act and it will be kinetic and people will lose their lives. And you don't see follow-on attacks after that.
Well, staying in the same geographic area, we haven't really said much about the DPRK, North Korea, another big player in nation-state espionage and frankly, cybercrime. You talked about it in at the HIP conference. Are there any updates or anything that you've seen or anything that we should know about? Or maybe just a start with a little bit of a background about the success of North Korea in supporting themselves.
Yeah, so North Korea is very interesting because this is a nation that is so poor, so sanctioned that they literally can't feed their people. I mean, people in Northern Korea live off of eating grass and whatever animals they can kill in the yard. And they use human fecal matter for material to fertilize because they don't have enough cows to do it. So the fact that they have built a nuclear program, which is capable of launching intercontinental ballistic missiles, is staggering. The question becomes, well, how have they done that? They've done that through illicit cyber operations and crypto mining and those types of things. And it's kind of crazy when you tell people, or I tell people, like, think about this. If you had your crypto wallet hacked, yeah, I did. Okay, great. You should have a sticker on the side of the next nuclear weapon to leave North Korea because you contributed to it. And China and North Korea work together. Not all of the North Korean stuff comes through North Korea because they don't have enough internet. A lot of times they send people to China and back and forth to engage in those operations.
Interesting. I attended a keynote where the speaker said that there were 12,000 people in North Korea that had the full-time occupation of hacker associated with it.
Of those 12,000, my question would be, how many of those 12,000 have visas that get them into mainland China, and how often do they visit?
Right. What is the interaction between the two? Because again, and as you said, and as we have seen, China will say anything and then do anything else.
I mean, they signed the Paris Climate Accord and then they built, I think they're averaging like a few hundred coal-fired power plants every 6 months. So, you know, it's one of those things of, sure, I'll gladly sign your paper because I really don't care, but I'm going to do what I'm going to do anyway. And you're not going to stop me. So tough.
Right. And so referring back to Russia, you're saying essentially that their goals are more for creating chaos than anything else and influence?
Yeah, I mean, from the Russian side, and I wouldn't consider myself a Russia expert, but I talk with a lot of them. I think really their goal is like, look, if we're not going to be the superpower, no one else will. That's kind of where they want to operate is we'll make sure we bring everyone down to our level. And the United States is obviously enemy number one. So let's just figure out how we can continue to cause enough chaos there. And I mean, the other thing that people should also be aware is, and this has been reported, if you go look at it, last year, I want to say about 100 Americans died because they couldn't get medical care in hospitals that were under ransom attack. Mm. That, if you ask me, like if I was SecDef, that's a declaration of kinetic activity if I ever saw one. If American citizens are dying in the homeland because of a cybersecurity activity that we can tie towards another nation state, if Chase Cunningham was SecDef, we'd be flinging metal downrange.
And as you say, the challenge on this is attribution.
The challenge is attribution, and attribution is always very, very suspect. I think without a human resource that's inside of the organization that you're targeting to verify that, yes, they literally basically launched this attack, if you're lucky if you can get to 80% guess, you know. But I mean, we went after bin Laden with only 50% certainty, so.
Right. So last year you also said that when you were working with federal agencies and legislators, they didn't seem to get it around cyber. They thought it was annoying and they were hoping that it was going away. They didn't get the importance of cybersecurity on national security. Has that changed at all? What do you think is going on right now in terms, because things have certainly changed around a bit in a number of different directions in cyber around the federal government and their initiatives and their funding. Where do you think we stand now on that?
I think honestly, it bothers me the way that things are going, just because, and again, I'm not a political person, but I think that some of the people that we've appointed, like literally Sean Carencross, and you can look it up during his testimony for his position appointment, he said, I don't know much about cyber. And it was like, wait a minute, you're the guy that's going to be the director of national cyber, and you're literally telling Congress you don't know much about it? That seems like a problem. And we've removed a lot of people that were pretty good at cyber and put them in other places or just gotten rid of them entirely. There's agencies as well that seem like they're going to collapse in on themselves for a whole bunch of reasons between cuts and et cetera. So I personally am not too thrilled about the way that things have been going. I think that there's great people up there that want to do the right thing, but it's also the fact is not a lot of people on the Hill really understand this space all the way down to the technical side of it. I mean, if you look at Congress and the Senate, we've got 400 plus representatives. Do you know how many of them have actually have degrees in technology or cyber? One.
I was going to raise one hand. Yeah.
Yeah. One person, right? We had two. Will Hurd was the other guy. Will Hurd quit because he was so sick of things. Now we have one. So that seems like a problem to me.
Right. Right. Okay. And so from an individual business cybersecurity viewpoint, we're pretty much on our own or within the industry circling the wagons to try to make things better.
Yeah. I mean, I just tell people, think about it like you're trying to protect your home. You know, I just want to be a harder target than the house down the street. And a rising tide, unfortunately, does not lift all ships here. But if I can keep people from robbing me, then Chase wins. I can't fix you. I can try, I can advise, I can help, I can offer services, et cetera. But at the end of the day, you're responsible for your own organization. And, you know, the famous quote from Ronald Reagan, I'm from the government, I'm here to help. You never want to hear that.
Right. Right. Well, literally, the last person I was talking to on this podcast, I used the quote from that I've been using increasingly from Rachel Wilson, who is the former head of offensive cyber at NSA, said, you don't want to be the slowest gazelle in the herd, basically.
Yep. I mean, it's, you know, something as simple as, even if it's not, you don't have the ADT service, putting an ADT sign outside of your home that you buy at Home Depot drives crime down by like 30%. It's the same thing in cyber. Just be a slightly harder target and make it not worth their time and you're better off. Nation state, different story. You're not going to stop a nation state, but the general kind of hackery stuff is defensible.
Right, right. Well, gosh, Chase, thanks. Again, unfortunately, it's not as uplifting as we would like it to be, but that's the world as we see. We'll add you to the, I have to look up who the mythical character is that cries out about the four horsemen, and we'll put you in that category there, but that's okay. You know, we need to understand it's really important, especially I think people understand there's been enough about cybercrime that people, and when I say people, I mean in regular old organizations trying to figure out what's going on, are getting a fairly good sense of it. But nation state is another matter. It's another degree of seriousness. And as I think you have said, it's you're either on their radar or you're not. And I think that there's not necessarily a lot that you can do in that area to not be on their radar, but you have to be prepared for all aspects of it. Well, thank you. Always interesting to chat. And you bring a perspective that I think is really important to understand. And I like the way you so much of this is geopolitical, is driven by geopolitics. And even if you are someone that works in a SOC or this is my area and that's what I care about. The reality is all of this affects what you care about. And that's why it's important to be aware of. Thank you. And thank you for attendees for listening to this. This is the HIP podcast sponsored by Semperis. And we'll talk again soon. Thank you.